This episode's audio was generated using AI technology.
You know, when you look at the dashboard of a car, there's that red zone on the tachometer, the red line.
Right, the danger zone.
Exactly. It's the absolute maximum limit before the engine literally, you know, tears itself apart. And we're taught to never keep the needle there. It is for short, desperate bursts only. But what if someone didn't just touch the red line, but what if they pinned the needle there for 45 days straight?
Which is just, I mean, it's almost impossible to comprehend.
It really is. Welcome to another episode of The Steady State. Today, we are exploring the extreme edges of physical fitness, nutrition, and really the psychology of consistency. We're doing it by analyzing the mind-boggling achievements of endurance athlete Nick Fowler.
Yeah, and it's quite the story.
It's wild. Our mission for this discussion of the sources is to extract practical, science-backed lessons from his absolute extremes that you, the listener, can actually apply to your own sustainable health and fitness habits.
Because it truly is the ultimate case study in pushing the human machine to its absolute breaking point and then somehow finding a way to keep it running.
Exactly.
And to map this out, we're not just looking at a single highlight reel. We are pulling from a really massive web of data. I mean, we're talking official route guidelines, raw race logs, some incredibly revealing long-form audio interviews he's done recently on the FKT podcast, gear breakdowns, and even the live on-the-ground reactions from the ultralight hiking community on the PCT subreddit as they watched him do this in real time.
And for those of you watching the video feed, you can see our expert as backdrop has shifted today to a rugged topographical map of the American West, which is, you know, exactly where this story unfolds. So, okay, let's unpack this. Before we can understand how Nick Fowler accomplished these physical feats, we really have to understand what he did.
Right. The context is everything here.
Because in this specific corner of the endurance world, the strict rules of the trail completely dictate the physical toll on the body. We're talking about the world of FKTs, or fastest known times. So how does this ecosystem actually work?
Well, the FKT community is entirely self-policed, and it operates on a very strict set of guidelines that break attempts down into specific styles. And the two major ones you really need to understand to grasp the scale of what Nick did are supported and self-supported.
Okay, break those down for me.
So a supported attempt is exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah.
You can have as much help as you can possibly coordinate. You have a dedicated crew.
Like a NASCAR pit crew almost.
Exactly like that. They drive ahead of you in a van. They cook your hot meals. They set up your tent. They pace you on the trail to keep your speed up. They drain your blisters. And they hand you water so you don't even have to stop moving. In that category, literally all you have to do is run.
Which, let's be honest, is still insanely hard when you're covering thousands of miles.
Oh, absolutely. It's a massive athletic feat. But then there's the self-supported category.
And that's where the rules change completely.
It's a completely different universe. In a self-supported attempt, you have absolutely no crew. You cannot use a vehicle to skip any steps, and you cannot have anyone following you around. You have to physically walk into every single resupply town to buy your own food off the shelves, or you have to like mail boxes of dehydrated food to yourself at remote post offices along the route months in advance.
Wow, so no quick pit stops.
None. There is no hitchhiking. There is no dedicated outside help of any kind. I mean, if your backpack strap breaks, you fix it. If you need water, you have to hike down to a stream and filter it yourself. You carry your shelter, your sleeping bag, your food, and your survival gear on your back the entire way.
Which makes the numbers from his Pacific Crest Trail run absolutely staggering. The PCT, for those who don't know, runs 2,650 miles from the Canadian border all the way down to Mexico. It crosses the Cascades, the Sierra Nevada, and the Mojave Desert.
Yeah, some of the harshest terrain in the country.
And based on his official logs, Nick Fowler hiked that entire distance in 45 days, 17 hours, and 47 minutes.
And here is the metric that just broke everyone's brains. He did this entirely self-supported, carrying all of his own gear, and he beat the previous supported record, which was held by a phenomenal athlete named Aurelian Sanchez. He beat it by over 2 hours.
That is just insane. I want you to really picture this mechanism. It's like racing someone coast to coast, only your opponent has a pit crew pumping their gas and handing them sandwiches through the window while you are on a bicycle fixing your own flat tires and foraging for snacks, and you still beat them.
It really defies logic.
Right. I mean, is it even fair to compare these two categories of physical fitness?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the self-supporting constraints actually force an entirely different physiological and psychological strategy. There was a massive thread on the Pacific Crest Trail subreddit while Nick was doing this, and one commenter perfectly captured the difference. They compared supported athletes to bus drivers and self-supported athletes to astronauts.
Astronauts, I love that.
It's so accurate because they exist in completely different paradigms. The supported athlete is optimizing for pure athletic speed. You know, they're light, fast, and constantly tethered to a lifeline. The self-supported athlete is optimizing for survival, logistics, and continuous heavy mechanical load. Nick wasn't just running. He was moving a loaded pack and averaged 57 miles a day.
57 miles. Yeah. Every single day. To move that much with a heavy pack across mountains and deserts, your body basically becomes a raging furnace. Which brings us to the next massive challenge. How do you feed that furnace when you have to physically carry the fuel on your own back?
Right. It becomes a problem of sheer thermodynamics. You're burning calories at a rate that the human digestive system is barely equipped to replace.
And the caloric math here is just wild. When you look at the breakdowns published in places like Marathon Handbook on the PCT, Nick increased his daily intake from 10,000 calories during a previous attempt up to 12,000 calories a day.
12,000. Let that sink in.
I can't even imagine eating that much. And to hit that number, he heavily relied on sugary drinks. Specifically, he was just slamming bottled Starbucks Frappuccinos. And on a different run, his 800-mile Arizona trail sprint, he ramped his intake from 300 up to 600 calories an hour.
Yeah, he was just constantly eating.
Constantly. He was surviving on a custom 800-calorie oatmeal recipe, protein shakes, and coconut creamer coffee.
And yet, even while forcing down 12,000 calories a day on the PCT, he still lost 15 pounds of body weight over the 45 days.
Seriously, 15 pounds.
Yeah, his body was cannibalizing itself because he simply couldn't eat enough to match the output.
Wait, hold on. We talk on this show about eating healthy food for sustainable habits. You're telling me he's drinking 12,000 calories of Frappuccinos and coconut creamer? That sounds like a Thanksgiving dinner mashed up with a massive sugar crash. Every single day. I have to push back here. Is this actually nutrition or just desperate survival thermodynamics?
It is absolutely desperate survival thermodynamics. And the underlying biology of why he has to eat this way is just fascinating.
Okay, lay it on me.
Well, when a human being is on their feet under load for 18 hours a day, our traditional paradigms of clean eating are temporarily suspended. In the sports science world, we look at something called splanchnic vasoconstriction.
Okay, you're going to have to translate that for me. Splanchnic what?
Splanchnic vasoconstriction. Splanchnic just refers to your gut and abdominal organs. Vasoconstriction means the narrowing of blood vessels.
Ah.
Okay. So when you are hiking 57 miles a day, your body is in an extreme state of physical stress. Your brain recognizes that your leg muscles desperately need oxygen and nutrients to keep moving, so it literally shunts the blood away from your digestive system and redirects it to your legs. Your stomach essentially shuts down.
Oh, wow. So if you try to eat like a massive salad with lean chicken breast, your stomach literally doesn't have the blood flow required to break down the complex fibers and proteins.
Precisely that. The gut simply cannot handle the volume or the complexity. On top of that, in the ultralight hiking community, they experience something called hiker hunger.
Hiker hunger.
Yeah. And when your energy expenditure is that immense, your body doesn't care about a balanced, heart-healthy Mediterranean diet. It cares about pure caloric density and immediate glycogen replenishment.
It just needs energy fast.
Exactly. Fat has the highest caloric density per gram, making it the most efficient way to carry in your pack. And simple sugars, like those in a Frappuccino, require almost no digestion. They pass straight into the bloodstream to provide immediate fuel for muscles that are actively working.
Because if you tried to get 12,000 calories entirely from kale and lean protein, you'd have to carry like 40 pounds of food just for one day.
Yeah, good luck with that.
You physically couldn't carry the weight of it, and your stomach would completely revolt while you were moving.
That's the core of it. High-calorie liquids and easily digestible simple sugars are often the only things the gut can handle without going into intense cramping or vomiting. But to your point, this is absolutely not a blueprint for everyday sustainable health.
Right. Please do not start drinking 5 frappuccinos a day.
No, do not do that. It's a highly specialized strategy for a temporary extreme event. The practical takeaway for our listeners isn't the frappuccinos. It's the underlying principle of energy matching. Your nutritional intake must intentionally match your physical output.
So, like, if you dramatically increase your training volume, say you start training for a marathon or you double your gym sessions, you cannot maintain a highly restrictive diet and expect your body to recover.
Exactly. You have to fuel the machine for the actual work it's doing.
Okay. So you've got this internal furnace burning at 12,000 calories just to keep the engine moving, but that internal heat doesn't mean much when the outside world is actively trying to freeze you. Let's look at how physical fitness collides with a severe lack of recovery.
This is where it gets pretty grim.
Yeah. The details from his Arizona trail run are incredibly visceral. Nick's 30-degree synthetic sleeping quilt got soaked in massive rainstorms, and then the temperature dropped, and the quilt literally froze solid.
Just brutal.
He was surviving on almost zero sleep, shivering through the nights. On the PCT, he was dealing with so much friction from sweating in the desert that he actually took a knife and sliced ventilation holes into his running shorts to prevent chafing.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
Right. He changed his socks every 100 miles, like clockwork, and he burned through 15 pairs of trail running shoes, getting a fresh pair mailed to him every 150 to 180 miles.
Which highlights a crucial aspect of physical consistency that most people completely overlook, and that is that gear maintenance is body maintenance. Changing your socks and swapping out your shoes isn't just about avoiding the discomfort of a blister. It's about protecting the kinetic chain.
The kinetic chain meaning how every joint and muscle is connected from the ground up?
Exactly. Let's look at the biomechanics of a simple blister. If your feet get wet, the skin softens, friction increases, and a blister forms. Your brain registers that pain, and subconsciously, you alter your gait.
Like you start limping a tiny bit.
Right, you start stepping just a little bit differently to avoid putting pressure on that spot on your heel. That tiny subconscious alteration in how your foot strikes the ground puts asymmetric stress on your ankle. Your knee then has to compensate for the ankle, your hip compensates for the knee, and your lower back compensates for the hip.
Oh man, it just travels all the way up.
Yep. Over the course of 50 miles, a simple blister can cascade up the kinetic chain and result in a systemic, season-ending joint injury. Nick, managing his footwear so meticulously, you know, changing shoes before the foam completely compressed and lost its shock absorption, is exactly how he protected his structural integrity.
That makes total sense. We often think of injuries as these sudden traumatic events, but really they are usually a cascade of tiny compensations.
Very often, yes.
But then there's the sleep factor, and this is where I get completely lost. On the 13-day Arizona trail run, Nick survived on just 3 hours of sleep a night.
3 hours.
He openly reported that by day 9, his brain was completely fried. I mean, operating on 3 hours of sleep completely flies in the face of everything we know about recovery, cognitive function, and muscular repair. How doesn't his body just snap in half?
Well, the short answer is it almost did snap, and Nick actually recognized that. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the Arizona Trail was a relatively shorter effort, around 2 weeks of total running. You can mortgage your sleep for a short period, essentially taking out a physiological loan on adrenaline and sheer willpower, but the interest rate on that loan is incredibly high.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Let's look at the science of sleep debt. When you sleep, you cycle through deep restorative sleep and REM sleep. During these cycles, your brain utilizes something called the glymphatic system.
Which is like a waste clearance system for the brain, right?
Yes, exactly. Throughout the day, as your neurons fire, they produce metabolic waste products, including neurotoxins. When you sleep, cerebrospinal fluid washes through the brain and clears out those toxins.
So it's literally washing your brain.
Basically, yeah.
Right.
If you only sleep for 3 hours, you aren't completing enough REM cycles, and that glymphatic clearance doesn't fully happen. The toxins literally build up in the brain tissue. By day 9, cognitive decline sets in severely.
Which explains why he felt fried.
Right. Your prefrontal cortex, which handles logic and decision-making, it starts to misfire. You experience intense emotional volatility, a breakdown of fine motor skills, and in extreme endurance scenarios, outright hallucinations.
Which is exactly what happened on the trail. He actually got so disoriented from the sleep deprivation that he got completely lost and added 11 bonus miles to his route because he couldn't navigate a simple trail junction properly.
And out there, that lack of navigation could have been catastrophic. But what is so impressive here is how he treated that failure as an aggressive learning opportunity.
Oh.
Well, for the much longer 45-day Pacific Crest Trail effort, he completely shifted his strategy. He didn't try to sleep 3 hours a night for a month and a half because he knew he would literally die. Instead, he slowed his actual physical running pace down, but he increased his time on feet to 18 hours a day.
Wow, so he's moving slower, but for way longer.
Exactly. He recognized that for long-term physical consistency, you have to adjust the balance between pacing and resting.
Mm.
He gave himself just enough sleep to allow the lymphatic system to clear the critical toxins and prevent a systemic breakdown. He proved that sometimes moving slower but longer and allowing for baseline recovery is vastly more efficient than sprinting, accumulating massive sleep debt, and just crashing.
So you can dial in the calories with liquid sugars, you can slice holes in your shorts for ventilation, and you can map out your sleep cycles to clear brain toxins. But at a certain point, the body will usually quit before the mind does. How do you build a mind capable of this? Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, his backstory is wild.
Based on his recent interview on the FKT podcast, Nick Fowler is not some lifelong, genetically engineered endurance runner who has been doing this since childhood.
Far from it. He is a remarkably recent addition to this sport.
Right. He only started hiking in 2019. He went on a trip to Glacier National Park, simply wanted to hike up and touch a glacier, and accidentally went on a 32-mile hike that left him so profoundly sore he couldn't physically walk the next day.
We've all had those ambitious days.
Yeah, but he didn't even know what the acronym FKT meant until January of 2021. I want you to really think about that timeline. Is like a regular person picking up a tennis racket for the very first time, getting smoked by a ball machine, and then winning Wimbledon 5 years later. I mean, how does that kind of psychological leap even happen?
Well, it happens by fundamentally reframing the concept of failure.
Okay, tell me more.
In our day-to-day lives, we usually view failure as a stop sign. It means we aren't good at something, so we should probably try something else. Mick viewed failure purely as data acquisition. When he first discovered the world of fastest known times, he looked up the elite Belgian runner Karel Sabbe, who held some of the biggest records at the time. Nick tried to copy Karel's elite, high-mileage training plan.
And let me guess, it didn't go well.
The result? Nick broke his foot. His bone density and soft tissues simply weren't adapted for it.
And it gets worse. On his very first attempt at the Arizona Trail, long before he actually set the record, he ended up puking in the Grand Canyon by day two. He was so immobilized by nausea and fatigue that it took him 2 hours and 20 minutes just to hike a single mile out of the canyon.
Yeah, and for most people, that level of physical collapse and public failure is enough to make them hang up their running shoes forever. But Nick iterated. Instead of quitting, he looked at the data.
He adjusted.
Exactly. He realized he needed structural guidance, so he hired a coach, Joe McConaty, who is a legend in the sport and a former PCT record holder himself. Nick also learned from his 52-day PCT run in 2023. He analyzed every single inefficiency, every wasted minute in town, every blister, to shave his time down to that staggering 45 days in 2026.
He treated himself like a science experiment.
He really did. He also leveraged public accountability, announcing his attempts beforehand to lock in his habit formation. Putting his reputation on the line forced him to follow through on the dark mornings when he didn't really want to train.
But even with a great coach and public pressure, what happens at day 30 when everything hurts and you're eating coconut creamer out of a bag?
Well, that's where we get to the core of it. Beneath the coaching and the accountability, Nick's true superpower isn't his VO2 max. It's his mastery of what the outdoor community calls type 2 fun, combined with a brilliant utilization of the central governor theory.
Okay, let's break those down. First, type 2 fun. Meaning it is absolutely miserable while you were doing it, like freezing in a wet sleeping bag, but it feels deeply fun, rewarding, and character building in retrospect.
Yes, exactly. It is the ability to decouple your immediate physical discomfort from your overarching sense of purpose. You accept that pain is just a sensation, not a mandate to stop. But the central governor theory is even more fascinating.
I've heard a bit about this.
It's a concept in sports science, originally proposed by Dr. Tim Noakes, which suggests that the brain acts as a central governor to protect the body from catastrophic damage. Your brain is essentially a predictive engine, Long before your muscles actually run out of ATP, the energy currency of the cells, your brain will proactively induce the feeling of severe fatigue.
It tricks you.
Basically, it sends signals of pain and exhaustion to force you to slow down, holding back a massive reserve of energy just in case you need it for a life or death emergency.
So when we feel like we are completely tapped out and can't take another step, our bodies actually have plenty of fuel left, but our brain is lying to us to protect us.
Precisely. And this is where belief becomes a biological mechanism. Nick said it perfectly in one of his interviews. He said, if you don't believe it's possible, it won't be.
That is so true.
If you deeply believe you will fail, your brain's predictive engine confirms that bias and clamps down, proactively shutting down your muscles to conserve energy. But if you hold an unwavering belief in your capacity and you have trained your brain through repeated exposure to type 2 fun, you can essentially hack that central governor. You convince your brain that you are safe, which allows you to access those hidden reserves of energy that most people never tap into.
Man, that is powerful. So what does this all mean for us, the people who aren't trying to run 57 miles a day across a desert? Let's summarize the key takeaways. First, you don't need a massive support crew or the perfect expensive setup to achieve big fitness goals. A self-supported approach, driven by sheer grit and problem-solving, can sometimes outpace all the resources in the world.
Absolutely.
Second, your caloric intake has to honestly match your physical output. If you are asking your engine to do more work, you have to intentionally put more fuel in the tank, otherwise you'll cannibalize your own progress. Third, gear maintenance is body maintenance. Something as simple as changing your socks or ensuring your shoes are fresh can prevent a cascading kinetic chain failure.
That one is so important for everyday runners.
Oh, for sure. And finally, failure is just data for your next attempt. Breaking your foot or puking on a trail isn't the end of the story. It's just the rough draft of your training plan.
Those are the undeniable mechanics of high performance. But exploring all of this raises an important question, and it's something I want you, the listener, to really mull over.
Leave us with something deep.
In the Arizona Trail logs, amidst all the suffering and calorie counting, there's this profoundly human moment. Nick is pushing himself to the absolute brink, running on 3 hours of sleep, completely exhausted. And he passes a group of hikers who are just cowboy camping, you know, sleeping out under the open stars. And they're calmly watching a beautiful sunrise.
Just enjoying the morning.
Right. And in that moment of extreme suffering, Nick thinks to himself, I'd rather be watching the sunrise with my son than doing 65 miles a day.
Wow.
That hits hard.
He eventually pushed through that feeling and finished the record, but it brings up a vital tension that applies to all of us. In our own lives, when we push so hard to optimize our habits, hit our fitness milestones, and build unwavering consistency, at what point does the relentless pursuit of human performance start to cost us the simple joy of the human experience itself?
That is the ultimate balance we are all trying to strike, isn't it? Knowing exactly when to push the machine to the red line and knowing when to just stop, take off the pack, and watch the sunrise. Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Steady State. Stay curious, stay moving, and stay steady. And remember, it's okay to touch the red line every now and then. Just make sure you know why you're revving the engine in the first place.